This is your last chance to enter the Ohio Lottery's Fun Turns 50 promotion. Score $3,500 and two tickets to the epic party at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, where you could win part of another $400,000 in cash prizes. Enter the new 50th anniversary scratch-off or $50 worth of eligible non-winning $5 or $10 scratch-offs and My Lotto rewards through the Ohio Lottery app. Hurry up! The last entry deadline is May 13th. Lottery players are subject to Ohio laws and commission regulations. Play responsibly.
This is The Literary Life. I'm Mitchell Kaplan. I've owned Books and Books and been a bookseller for over 35 years. What you're about to hear are conversations about all things literary, with writers, readers, publishers, old friends, new friends, and anyone who might wander into our store with an interesting story to tell about their connection to books, reading, or writing. These will be informal, over-the-backyard-fence kind of conversations, the kind I and booksellers everywhere have each and every day. The third season of Poetry in America has just released, with 8 new episodes, once again highlighting the diversity of American poetry. I'm joined on this episode of The Literary Life by the series creator, Alyssa New, and Richard Blanco, inaugural poet who is featured in this season's second episode. I want to welcome you both to The Literary Life.
Thank you so much, Mitchell. Thanks, thrilled to Mitch. Be here.
Thanks, Mitch. Great to be here. Yes.
Well, it's always good to see you, Richard, and it's wonderful to meet you, Alyssa, as well. So, you know, I discovered Poetry in America by chance, you know, the very first season it was on. And as someone who loves poetry, I was just so taken and moved by what you were trying to do. Would you tell us a little bit about what Poetry in America is and about what you were trying to do with it?
Sure. Well, Poetry in America is a half an hour television series. And I begin with half an hour because it turns out that the half an hour that we use for news programs and situation comedies really perfect. It's a perfect amount of time to I think, give inexperienced readers of poetry that intense, immersive experience that a poem can offer them. And of course, we layer on music and historical context as necessary, and I hope beautiful imagery in order to give each of the poems we treat, a very vibrant kind of presentation. And we try to include poems from every historical period. Poems that are performed on stage, as well as, you know, sometimes poems we might think of as music, as popular music. We try to do an episode every season that connects poetry and science. But a major focus of the series is to really explore all of the American communities that, we are. And the episode with Richard is, a wonderful example of the opportunity we had through Richard's poem to really get into the cultural life of Cuban American families.
Richard, the poem that they feature is Looking for the Gulf Motel. So what was it like for you to have this poem featured in the way that it was? And did you have any apprehension about doing it?
Absolutely no apprehension. I love Elise's work because I'm a big sort of fan or champion of the public humanities. And I feel that the show Poetry in America sort of taking poetry out there and letting people have access to it in ways that they might not otherwise. I often people say, you know, oh, I don't get poetry. And I ask them, well, when was the last time you read a poem? And they're like, oh, I haven't read a poem in 20 years. I'm like, well, it's not that you don't get poetry. It's just you haven't given it a chance probably since high school. So that's one thing. But, this poem, I just knew Lisa was going to do a great job with it. And it's so visual, and it's so, it has so many senses, like 98% sensory detail. So I just figured out they're going to do something beautiful with it. The process of working through that, thinking about what we're going to show, in the midst of that, I gave Poetry in America a bunch of 8mm films that my mother had, and they were so gracious, and they restored some of them, had them digitally remastered, and so now I have a gift from them, another gift from them too. So that's preserved now in our family.
We had to buff them up a little bit.
Yeah.
They were beautiful. It just rounded out the entire experience from the poem. And the other thing that I really loved about it, and what I love about the show, Alyssa, is what you do is you show how just normal everyday people encounter poetry and what it means to them, young and old. I was particularly struck with the younger people who were experiencing it. And Richard, you can talk about your poem a little bit, but your poem does, in fact, it's kind of a nostalgic look at a time in your life when you were with your family and experiencing kind of a vacation, you might say, but a uniquely Cuban vacation.
I had moved back to Miami and wanted, where I grew up, obviously, and was taking those proverbial trips down memory lane. And one of these places is Marco Island, where we used to go back in the day when it was not overrun and overdeveloped as it is now. And but of course, I was expecting to just plug right back into where I left off 20 years earlier. And much to my surprise, that was not the case. So I felt at first very angry and hurt. How dare they do this to my life, my memories. And in the process of working out through the poem, I realized it was more a deeper sense of loss but also gaining, because it's like the old adage says, you don't know what you have until you lose it. So not having this place, or not having this Gulf Motel where we used to stay at, suddenly made me realize how much, what a beautiful and rich experience my life had been with my parents, even though at the time we were embarrassed of that, you're a kid, right? So that's what the poem sort of taught me. And it's interesting, I think, also because my partner Mark had said, you sound just like your mother, when I was complaining about, and I thought, what does he mean by that? And I realized that this is the way, in many ways, that my parents would talk about Cuba and their loss, right? Like, how dare they, or like, they changed this, or they changed the street names. And I realized that Marco Island was my own Cuba. And even though it's about a Cuban family, I really realized at that moment that loss and memory and nostalgia are really universal things that we all feel in one way or another. And so it was in my, my own context, in my own life, it was my first sort of deep sense of the loss of a place.
But all of us have experienced people who talk about, that the winds were cooler in Havana, the seas were calmer in Havana, and, the coffee was sweeter and all of that. And I think that kind of nostalgia you brought out so beautifully in your poem, and it resonated so deeply in what Alyssa did by bringing in other voices. Talk a little bit about some of the people you brought in to talk about that kind of nostalgia.
Poetry and memory are cousins. And one thing that a poem does is allow in language experience that's lost to be realized and overrealized often, right? Everything, what nostalgia does is it turns everything into an illustrated children's book. And that's what we did as well as using these nostalgic home movies that Richard's family had kept. We also used illustration in a way to dramatize how memory beautifies and creates narratives in places where that's all been broken up. But of course, I was immensely fortunate that Richard is friends with Gloria Estefan. And I did not know Gloria Estefan before this episode, and she loves Richard, loves the poem, and spoke with me for an hour, and not only spoke with me, but burst into song, which is what one, you know, I coaxed her a little bit. What did that sound like? But she sang throughout our interview and was extremely generous in helping us, of course, to get rights to some of what she sang. We also filmed a restaurateur and Grammy-winning singer who had grown up in Miami, child of Cuban parents. We interviewed his girlfriend, who is a beautiful actress, who had just come. And it turned out, this is a little behind the scenes gossip, as we were filming, the videographer who'd been filming kept saying, "My parents were just like that. We brought all of our food." This is literally the person we had hired. And at the after we'd listened to him a few times, we said, "Would you like to just come on the other side?" And so one of the people was, and this is not the first time this has happened in this show, where someone accidentally, and I will, you know, maybe you'll use this and maybe you won't, but when we were filming our season one episode on the hip hop singer Nas, I was taking a cab to a studio in Bushwick, Brooklyn, from Manhattan. And my cab driver said, what are you doing in Bushwick? And I said, "Oh, I'm filming for a television show on Nas." And she said, "Nas, I love Nas." And she starts rapping. And she goes, "And I'm a hip hopist, you know?" I go, "Really?" And she's talking and talking and talking. And I said, "Well, you want to be in the show?" And she said, "Well, I don't have any makeup on." I said, "Well, you have to go home, get some makeup on, and then come back." And she's extraordinary. And I think the reason that works is because poems tell us how to read them. You don't have to be an expert to read a poem. You do have to kind of sit down and pay attention a little bit, but as soon as you actually have the language of a poem in front of you, it's going to start giving you directions. It's going to start telling you, you know, it's going to start having flavors or conjuring images. And if all someone like me does is say, "Name them," then, you know, what do you hear there? What did you smell there? Then a kind of sophisticated literary interpreter begins to develop before our eyes. And that for me is one of the magical parts of the show, that the vast majority of people we bring onto it are not experts in poetry, but they develop perspectives in the course of a 40-minute interview and begin to see patterns that they follow up on. And by the end, they're just sort of, they've made themselves not experts, but what's the word? Residents of the land of poetry.
The show has a bigger profile as well, because you also use it as an educational tool, right? It's part of a larger project. And I think that what you've done, and tell me what you think about this, is that we haven't really done a very good job in this country of the way we teach the appreciation of poetry. And I think what you're trying to do is change that a little bit. Am I right?
I am certainly trying to change that. It isn't very radical, really, what I do. The conversations we have on this show are the kind of conversation, if you're lucky enough to be in a great high school classroom, a great one, or a great college seminar, you might be having. But those experiences are probably thin on the ground for many people. And so I am trying, both in the way we make the show and in the way I draw on it, to create educational content that then becomes part of both non-credit and for-credit experiences that are now being offered at scale through Arizona State University because I got a little too big for Harvard. I needed a sort of an engine that was really ready to educate the many. But and it has been immensely gratifying to see how drawing on the tools that we now have, the media tools we now have, as educators, we can offer learners something much more potent and exciting and engaging than certainly I was able to offer. You know, as hard as I tried, standing behind a podium in front of a blackboard, facing a row of chairs, and even filming that experience, no matter how much I wave my arms, is different from being able to show a viewer what a guy who's squeezing orange juice by the side of the road looks like. And it wasn't long ago that before video that it was too expensive to even imagine education using tools of video and audio, but now we can.
What did you learn about Miami?
I lived in Miami for a few years, and my first child was born in Miami, and I went to Books and Books a lot when I was in Miami.
Oh, really?
And so I and my first husband was born and raised in Miami Beach. So I have my own little Gulf Most Hell story. I'm happy to say that Books and Books in Coral Gables, I believe, is still on the same corner. And so I hope you haven't moved, because I'll feel violated by that. But
well, it makes you almost a native then, if all
so
of that.
I was there when you have your first child in a place, it does make it part of you. And so I filmed in Miami Beach, where my husband had been from, which was completely different than when I first started going there in the 70s. But what did I learn about Miami? This changes the subject a little bit. I felt more and more how Miami Jews and Miami Cubans are the same people. And there is a kind of gusto and robust enjoyment of the physical world and of including of the world of Miami that that feels to me has had a shaping effect on the city. And I know that any people have recently, friends of mine have started watching, and all the Jewish ones say that was exactly like my family. You know, my mother embarrassed me by bringing too much food. Not everyone's family is like that. And one of the reasons that Richard's poem was so ideal for this show is that it's both universal in the best way and particular in the best way. It's particular in that it teaches us the ways of another culture and allows us, like, I love when Gloria Estefan's talks about the glamour of Cuban women who would never go out with rollers in their hair, who wore heels when they were vacuuming, right? That's a specific, you know, cultural folk waves of a kind that you have to learn about from someone who knows. And at the same time, everybody is embarrassed by their parents. Everyone does remember their family vacations in a potent way. And so to work with Richard with a poem that is accessible to everyone and yet also allows us to learn something about people from a culture where it's different from ours. To learn about Cuba. Not everybody in Miami might know that the coffee was sweeter, but people who watch this show in other parts of the country really don't know that.
Richard, would you read Looking for the Gulf Motel for us?
Sure. I just wanted to add back to the idea of what the series is doing so wonderfully. In a way, it's making poetry come alive. And I think that poetry and the teaching of poetry should be taught as an experience and much more like song. You know, we don't always understand what a song means, but we feel it. And like Lisa was saying, if you just enter the poem, just sit with it. And it's, you know, poetry's DNA is in music, right? In oral tradition. And it comes out of me in the way that it inspires and is sort of breathes in me like music. And I almost feel like we should teach poetry with music and drama as well, because they're so related. So anyway,
I just need to say, you know, before you read, you know, Richard, you know, I've seen you read in so many different forums and so many different places, and there's no one better to capture what you just said during a poetry reading than Richard Blanco. So, you know, you've got that nailed, you know, in terms of the way you engage an audience and what you use to engage that audience. So, and I think that's what Alyssa does. I mean, right. When I watched her do that, you know, when I watched that episode, it, you know, there was no dissonance with your poem and what Alyssa was doing in her episode.
Yeah, they're both making poetry come to life, and going to a poetry reading now becomes a deeper experience, right? I always say it's like going to the concert, right? You can listen to the music at home, but you go to the concert and it's a whole, and I think of my readings as concerts, actually. So, well, I gave you the backstory to the poem, so here we go. Looking for the Gulf Motel, Marco Island, Florida. There should be nothing here I don't remember. The Gulf Motel with mermaid lampposts and ship's wheel in the lobby should still be rising out of the sand like a cake decoration. My brother and I should still be pretending we don't know our parents, embarrassing us as they roll the luggage cart past the front desk, loaded with our scruffy suitcases, 2 dozen loaves of Cuban bread, brown bags bulging with enough mangoes to last the entire week, our espresso pot, the pressure cooker, and a pork roast reeking garlic through the lobby. All because we can afford to eat out, not even on vacation. Only 2 hours from our home in Miami, but far enough away to be thrilled by the whiter sands on the west coast of Florida, where I should still be, for the first time, watching the sun set instead of rise over the ocean. There should be nothing here I don't remember. My mother should still be in the kitchenette of the Gulf Motel, her daisy sandals from Kmart squeaking across the linoleum, still gorgeous in her teal swimsuit and amber earrings, stirring a pot of arroz con pollo, adding sprinkles of onion powder and dollops of tomato sauce. My father should still be in a terry cloth jacket, smoking, clinking a glass of amber whiskey in the sunset at the Gulf Motel, watching us dive into the pool. Two boys he'll never see grow into men who will be proud of him. There should be nothing here I don't remember. My brother and I should still be playing Parcheesi. My father should still be alive, slow dancing with my mother on the sliding glass balcony of the Gulf Motel. No music. Only the waves keeping time. A song only their minds hear, 10,000 nights back to their life in Cuba. My mother's face should still be resting against his bare chest, like the moon resting on the sea. And the stars should still be turning around them. There should be nothing here I don't remember. My brother should still be 13, sneaking rum in the bathroom and sculpting naked women from sand. And I should still be 8 years old, dazzled by seashells and how many seconds I can hold my breath underwater. But I'm not. I'm 38, driving up Collier Boulevard, looking for the Gulf Motel, for everything that should still be, but isn't. I want to blame the condos, their shadows for ruining the beach and my past. I want to chase the snowbirds away with their tacky McMansions and yachts. I want to turn the golf courses back into mangroves. I want to find the Gulf Motel exactly as it was and pretend for a moment nothing lost is lost.
Nothing lost is lost.
Yes, there's something there.
I wish that we could all pretend that that was the case.
I think part of also the universality for me of this poem is that what I learned through it too, that it was more than nostalgia, right? It was this idea of loss. And also that while recognizing that the motel is not there, also recognizing that your memories are not lost. And so the poem is also about loss, but it's also about receiving, because if I hadn't gone to Marco Island, I would have never treasured those memories as much. And so in a way, and also mortality, right? So it's like this idea that things change without your permission, right? That you don't have that agency, but you will always have those experiences. And that it, in a way, the poem is making peace with the loss of the place by sort of being fulfilled by the treasure of those and treasuring those memories. And I think we all go through that, no matter, you know, what culture, where we're from, what city you're talking about. Oh, we're in a constant stage of change, and it's something we confront. It's part of our human condition.
One of the things that's so beautiful about the poem is that it's also a story of a young person coming to consciousness. You know, to see the Gulf Motel like a sugar, you know, a birthday cake. I did commission a birthday cake. I wanted to film a very beautiful cake and had one made to do that. But, you know, the awareness of love and the erotic and romance that you start to see this young boy have in a very innocent way in the middle of the poem, as his brother's also sculpting naked women from sand. And, you know, by the end of the poem, we realize that there's been a loss with the father that, you know, is still being processed. And there's a maturational arc, you know, a whole developmental set of stages that this poem allows us to think through. And that's a lot to do in a poem that's also so beautiful and has so much great food in it. And it's really wonderful.
Yeah. And in a sense, the adult Richard is recognizing that memory now as not maybe what he did understand consciously then. So he's like sort of revisiting his young self and thinking about these incredible moments. And I was like, oh my God, that's when, like, so yeah, it's like my own consciousness as a child is triggering my own consciousness as an adult by looking at my childhood in a way that I never, because, you know, probably at the time, you know, I probably wasn't crazy about seeing my parents smooching, you know, and dancing. And of course, even the embarrassment is kind of also a threshold moment, right? You're differentiating yourself and trying to think about, no, we're not our parents, you know, we're becoming individuals, right? So there, yeah, thanks for that, Lisa. It's, I don't know how I did it, to be honest.
What a model they were for you too. I mean, it is also a beautiful portrait of a marriage.
Yeah.
And of a relationship. There was one boy whom I interviewed for the episode who was daring enough to say, you know, he can see that being an adult is really different. And he for me is a little kind of a proxy for you. He's like, I don't know about watching these people dance, but there's something on the other side of that door that I'm not yet ready for.
Yeah, it's weird because all our lives are imprinting, right? And then it imprinted probably my subconscious as this beautiful moment, except I wouldn't acknowledge it as a child. But now as an adult, I can go back and do that. Yeah, that's my favorite part in the poem too, that dancing.
Well, and the other really beautiful thing about it is through the act of remembering, nothing is really lost, right? So your parents are back, the Gulf Motel is back, and you brought it back for all of us. I mean, any of us who ever experienced anything like that. I also grew up on Miami Beach, and I remember my parents taking me to Marathon or the Keys, and, you know, and just listening to your poem brought back those memories. So it made my parents once again alive to me. Yeah. And I think that is the beauty of the way we communicate with one another and what poetry can do.
Yeah, I always say when I read this poem, I always say, I invite you to think about your own, quote, Gulf Motel experience or place that is always sort of a North Star in our life. When, you know, that's something that just is like these moments, because everybody has a Gulf Motel. And in that way, also, I think, getting back to the parallels with music, I always say the poem is a mirror. And at the end of the day, it's a mirror reflecting on you and your life, and you see yourself in it. Or at least that's the space. That's what I like a poem to do at its best. But like music, you know, we have these, you know, we're moved by music that has narratives and stories by other people that aren't ours, but somehow we're like, what? Like, and you're feeling it as if, because it's obviously connecting your own memory experience to theirs. And I think that's what art, poetry, if it can do that, I feel a poem has been a success. When someone tells me what you just said, Mitchell, that to me, then that's a poem.
And Alyssa, I just think it's kind of remarkable that you're creating this archive of the way people today interact with poetry and showing all of us the possibilities of what poetry can be, because, as you know, right now, as we speak, the arts, books, poetry, music, so many things are under attack right now. And I think what your series does is it shows how essential all of it really is.
Thank you. Well, and how it can give us joy, you know, how we, and I guess that's what you mean by essential, but I think that experience that we can have an encounter with a poem and go away feeling better, more thoughtful.
And it's humanizing. It's me having a window into Richard's experience, which is fundamentally different from any experience that I had, because we come from different, you know, different backgrounds. And it's a way that I can come to appreciate his background. If we isolate stories from one another, we're all in trouble. Instead, we need to be able to expose everybody to even more stories, whether it's through poetry, through fiction. And this whole idea of banning books and banning what's being taught is just so troubling to me right now as well. Why don't you tell us how we can see this episode and the entire series?
There are many ways. We live in a very complex era for TV watching. We stream the episode on our Poetry in America website, poetryinamerica.org. If one can't find it on one's dial, it airs nationally on PBS, but you have to check your local listings, and those local listings can change. It's airing nationally on the World Channel right now, and as the spring goes on, channels are bringing the series in into their lineup.
Well, I want to thank you, Richard, and you, Alyssa, for being on The Literary Life. And I want people listening to know that the episode featuring Richard and his poem will be featured in the link for the podcast. And on March 11th, we have a very, very special event for those of you living in Miami at Books and Books, where we'll be featuring Richard and we'll be featuring this episode. So, you know, go to booksandbooks.com and sign up so you get all of our emails to find out where, when, and how you can participate. Thank you again, guys.
Thank you, Mitchell, as always.